So now I'll go to chapter 2 then, which is a little bit of, hopefully, chemical review for you. The biology at the cellular level is just as much chemistry as it is biology. Because as I was saying last time, life, which is a process, is really just metabolism, which is chemistry, right? It's the sum of all the chemical reactions occurring in a cell. Of course, there are also physical aspects of life. The way things are structured and how the materials work are physical concerns. So biology is obviously not separate from physics and chemistry. And this is why cell biology or Bio 182 seems just as much like a chemistry class sometimes as a biology class. Well, the chemistry of biology or biochemistry or what's happening in cells involves just a relatively few of the more than 100 types of atoms that there are, right? If you look at the periodic table, there's all kinds of elements. But almost all of the atoms that make us up, and all organisms, not just us, are the four that you see here at the top: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And carbon has a special importance in biology, which is why, this underlies why life evolved. Carbon is a special atom, it's a special element. One of the reasons it's special, or actually several of the reasons that it has special properties, springs from the fact that it is tetravalent. Now, what does that mean? Yeah, tetra means four. So tetravalent means having a valence of four. But you need to be careful with the word valence, right? Because you can talk about valence electrons, you can talk about a valence shell, or you can talk about an atom's valence. And the number of valence electrons is not necessarily the same number as the atom's valence. So keep that in mind. The valence shell, well, first of all, atoms have shells, right, which are not really structures. They are spaces. Shells are energy levels spaced different distances from the nucleus. Within shells, which are themselves spaces, there are subspaces called subshells, right? The subshells get lettered. There are S subshells, there are D subshells, there are F subshells, and so on, right? Within subshells, which are spaces within spaces, there are sub-subspaces, which are orbitals, right? Is this all familiar to you? Okay. Orbitals are where you find electrons, maybe. So they are the spaces where orbitals can reside. Now, any individual orbital can contain at most two electrons, right? So it either has zero, it has one, or it has two electrons. Any orbital. But subshells contain different numbers of orbitals. S subshell, every S subshell has only one orbital, an S orbital, and therefore any S subshell can contain at most two electrons. P subshells, every individual P subshell, which there's one of for every shell, has three P orbitals in it, right? Which is why a P subshell can contain up to six electrons. Up to two in each of its P orbitals, of which there are three in that subshell. And you go up from there, adding more and more electrons, but that's going down in the periodic table. And most of the chemistry of life occurs just in those first couple of rows on the periodic table. What do we call rows on the periodic table? on the periodic table. Periods, yes. So just those top periods is really where all life is happening, almost all life is happening, which is why we pay so much attention to the so-called octet rule, right? The second shell, well, let me just quickly review the first shell. The first shell, the one closest to the nucleus, is the S shell, right? The first S. And like any S shell, which is the S subshell of the first shell, like any S subshell, contains only one orbital, an S orbital. So that first one is called the S1 orbital. Since that's the only orbital in the entire shell, that entire shell can hold up to two electrons only, which is why it fills up at two, and that's why the very first period on the periodic table has only two atoms in it, one on either corner, right? Hydrogen and helium. Helium is especially stable, like all of those noble gases on the right side, because its outer shell, its valence shell, in other words, is full. It's full at two simply because that inner shell, which is the only shell of those atoms, of those two atoms, can only hold two electrons. But a valence shell refers to the outermost shell that an atom has. The reason that's of particular importance is because chemistry is really just an interaction involving electrons when atoms meet. When atoms come into contact, it's not the nuclei that hit each other, right? The nuclei don't come into contact. The nuclei contain the protons and neutrons packed together pretty tightly. And then there's a lot of space compared to that diameter of the nucleus, which is where these orbitals are that I talk about. That's where you find the electrons. So if two atoms come into contact, it's the electrons that come into contact with each other. And that interaction between electrons from different atoms is what chemistry is, and therefore is what life is. All right. So anyway, that's why we pay attention to the outermost shells. If an atom has multiple shells, which it will the farther you go down the periodic table, it's only the outermost shells that are actually going to come into contact with each other, because that's the surface of the atom in a sense. And that's the ones that interact, not the inner electrons, the outer electrons. That's why we pay special attention to them and give them the special name of valence electrons. Valence electrons are just the electrons in the valence shell of an atom. Okay, well, there are some number of electrons in that valence shell, depending on the atom. We call all of those electrons in that valence shell valence electrons. And so you can talk about the number of valence electrons, right? That's the number of electrons that are in that valence shell already in that atom. But that's a different number, usually, from the valence. The valence is also a number. The valence of an atom is the number of additional electrons that would have to be added to that atom in order to bring that outer shell, that valence shell, to fullness. All right? In other words, it's how many atoms it takes to fill up the valence shell. That's what the valence is. Well, if you think about a hydrogen atom, it has its element number what? One, the simplest atom. So a typical neutral atom of hydrogen has just one proton and one electron. That's it. No neutrons. A typical one does. That means its only orbital that it has, and therefore the entire shell that it has, is half filled. So its number of valence electrons is one, But just by coincidence, its valence is also 1, because you have to add another 1 to 1 to get to 2, which is fullness for that first period. And that's why helium's happy. It's at 2. But when you go down a period to lithium and everything to the right of it, now you no longer have room for that third and beyond electron in that first shell, which is why you have the second shell, right? Well, the second shell has its own s orbital, which can hold up to 2 electrons, and it has 3 p orbitals in the x, y, and z directions, each of which can hold up to 2. So there's 4 orbitals overall in the second shell, an s and 3 p's, which is why the entire shell can hold up to 8 electrons. That's the basis of the octet rule. So for lithium and beyond, 8 is a special number when it comes to valence. Go ahead. A p orbital is an orbital that is a member of the p subshell, which is a subset of the shell it's in. Okay, the first shell has no p subshell. It has only an s subshell, which contains only an s orbital. These are all spaces. Right? Orbital, subshell, and shell in that first level are really the same size. At level 2, you have a brand new S subshell, which contains 1 S orbital. And you, in addition to that, in that same shell, you have a P subshell, which is made up of 3 different P orbitals. So, ignoring the inner shell, that second shell as a whole contains 2 subshells, an S and a P, which collectively contain 4 different orbitals. The S contains an S orbital. The P subshell contains 3 P orbitals. That's why it has 4 overall orbitals. And remember, an orbital, regardless of its designation, individually can handle only 2, maximally, electrons. That's why if you have 4 orbitals in a shell, that shell totally can hold only 8 electrons or fewer. All right, so that's why the octet rule is there. There is a special stability energetically to an atom if its valence subshells are filled. And that's why when you get to the right edge on the periodic table of the second period, you have what noble gas? Right under helium. Neon, yeah. Neon is another noble gas. It's happy just being an atom. It doesn't want to interact with other atoms because it already has its octet rule satisfied, has its valence satisfied. So it doesn't want to share electrons with anything else because it doesn't want to gain or lose any electrons. It's at that special stability already. Right? Everything to the left of that, though, is a little bit deficient in electrons with respect to filling that outer shell. And that's where valence comes in. The valence is how many electrons you have to add in order to make it just as happy as the noble gas. All right, so the valence is just 1 for hydrogen simply because it happens to only have that 1 shell. It only takes 1 to get it to 2. Well, carbon is like halfway between right and left on that second period. How many protons does carbon have? How many? 6, yeah. It's element number 6. By the way, that's what distinguishes an element, right? An element is it's whatever type of element it is for only one reason. And that's what? The number of protons that are in its nucleus. That's what makes, because all protons are the same, all electrons are the same as each other, all neutrons are the same as each other. It's just the number of protons, and that's it, not electrons or neutrons, that makes a given element what it is. Hydrogen is hydrogen simply because it has 1 proton exactly. And carbon is carbon simply because it has 6 protons exactly. Well, a neutral atom of carbon is neutral electrically because it has just as many electrons as it does protons. Electrons are much smaller than protons massively, but they have just as great a magnitude of charge as the protons do, just in the opposite direction. So a single tiny electron can electrically neutralize or undo with its negative charge the equally sized positive charge of a proton. And therefore, if you have as many protons as you have electrons, there is no overall charge. That's what a neutral atom is compared to an ion, right, which has gained or lost electrons. Not protons. If you gain or lose protons, you've changed the element. And that's nuclear physics, not chemistry anymore. Okay, so anyway, carbon has six protons, by definition. And a neutral atom of carbon, therefore, has six electrons as well. Two of those fill up the first shell. And so we ignore those because they're not really involved in the chemistry of carbon. That leaves four for its outer shell. That means it needs four additional ones to fill that outer shell to get to eight. So the number of valence electrons of carbon is four, but just by coincidence, again, just like hydrogen, its valence is also four, simply because four plus four equals eight. All right? What's to the right of carbon? Nitrogen. Seven protons, seven electrons, two of which are in the inner shell and we ignore, five valence electrons, though. So the number of valence electrons for nitrogen is five, but its valence is three, because eight minus five is three. You need three additional ones. Okay? So don't confuse number of valence electrons, which is one number, with valence, which is potentially and usually a different number. Now, another way of thinking about an atom's valence is that it is the number of bonds that it is going to want to make, in a sense, if you let me anthropomorphize the atom. It doesn't really want anything, but if an atom's valence is one, like in hydrogen, then it's going to make one bond in order to stabilize itself. And that's why hydrogen gas is not monatomic, right? Hydrogen gas is H2. They make a deal whereby each of them shares its one electron with the other so that both of them get credit for both of those electrons. That's what a covalent bond is, a sharing of electrons so that each of the two atomic nuclei get credit for all of the shared electrons. And so a single covalent bond, keep in mind, always contains two electrons. A single bond is a pair of electrons, one being donated to the arrangement, to the cooperative arrangement, from each of the two atoms. All right? So two hydrogens getting together, forming a single covalent bond, which is a pair of electrons, means that each hydrogen involved really gets credit for both of those electrons, which brings it up to two, which makes it just like helium, nice and satisfied. And that's why hydrogen is only going to form one bond with other atoms, whether it's another hydrogen or anything else. That's why valence is an important number. Valence tells you how many bonds are going to be made by that given atom. Well, carbon, being midway, is tetravalent. It's kind of half-filled in its second shell, and therefore it takes four atoms to satisfy it. It has a valence of four, and therefore it's always going to form four bonds. All right? This is really important to biology because that gives it an especial versatility with respect to how many different kinds of molecules can be made. And by the way, we should define molecule because sometimes that's misused. A molecule, officially, is a group of atoms that are bonded together by covalent bonds, which is just one type of chemical bond. What's the other type of chemical bond? Ionic bonds. Now, there are other types of bonds, but they're not really chemical bonds. A chemical bond is a bond that, when it occurs, changes the nature of the substance. For instance, sodium and chlorine, two elements, right? Neither one of which you want to come into contact with at all. Dangerous stuff in both cases. Sodium is an explosively reactive metal. You don't want to mix it with water. Enough water on the palm of your hand so that if you touch it, you're going to be in trouble. Okay, so you don't want sodium around you in pure form. Chlorine, poisonous gas in elemental form. Going to kill you. But when you get the two together, sodium and chlorine are going to exchange electrons, which is what chemistry is, form ions, right? Sodium is going to form a cation, a positively charged ion, by losing an electron, and that's because it's over on the left edge. It only has one electron in that outer shell. It's much easier to just lose that electron, in which case we don't even count that shell anymore, and now its new outer shell is the one beneath that. It's already filled. Than it is to gain seven additional ones to get all the way to the right side, like neon. All right, so that's why metals, which are on the left side of the periodic table, form ions by losing electrons. And when you lose electrons, you're losing negative charges, and therefore the positive charges that were there always to begin with from the protons are no longer fully neutralized, and positivity comes through, depending on how many electrons you lose, right? So a group 1 metal, something in that leftmost group, the columns are groups, if it loses an electron, which all of those do to form ions, then it'll become a plus 1 ion, a cation. It's very willing to do that because that's going to satisfy its valence by eliminating that outer shell and reverting to a full inner shell. Things on the right edge, except for the noble gases, ones that are just one electron away from being like the noble gases, in other words, deficient by just one electron from being stabilized, like chlorine, it's much easier for them to gain one additional electron than it is to lose their seven that they have in that outer shell. So sodium and chlorine getting together, they're reciprocal in a sense. The sodium has no problem giving up its one electron, and the chlorine, that's exactly what it wants. So nonmetals on the right side of the periodic table form ions by gaining electrons. And that makes them anions, right? Well, all ions have charge. But if you have two ions together of opposite charge, which you do in the sodium and the chlorine case, where they're no longer called that in the case of chlorine, so now it's a sodium ion and a chloride ion, they're oppositely charged ions. And oppositely charged particles attract each other electrostatically. That electrostatic attraction is what the ionic bond is. That's what holds those two ions together. But those electrons are almost always the property of whatever atom they're associated with at the time. It's the electrostatic attraction that holds them together. That changes the nature of the stuff. So we go from having a reactive metal and a poisonous gas to a new compound now, sodium chloride, which is not only not going to hurt us, it's absolutely essential for our life. That's what chemistry does. Just a simple rearrangement of electrons totally changes the nature of the substances. Okay? But that's why it's called a chemical bond, because it changes the nature of the chemical. Well, that's much stronger type of bond than hydrogen bonds, for instance, which we'll talk about in a minute, but not nearly as strong as a covalent bond. which is a bond based on the sharing of electrons continuously by both of the atoms involved. So covalent bonds are the strongest of the chemical bonds. It gives that kind of, it gives that molecule, which it's officially okay to call that a molecule since it's covalent bonds, special stability. It's hard to break covalent bonds, in other words, compared to ionic bonds. But back to why I was saying molecule is sometimes misused. Officially, you should use the word molecule to refer only to covalently bonded materials. In other words, there is officially no molecule of sodium chloride or any other salt. A salt is an ionic compound. It doesn't share electrons, right? It exchanges them. So what do we call, well, in the case of a molecule, oxygen, for instance, is a molecule. And so we can have oxygen as a gas, some number of molecules, right? It's all oxygen if you have a pure sample. But the smallest piece of oxygen, molecular oxygen that you can have, would be just a single molecule, right? And if you have a bunch of them, like you do in a liter of gas, even though they're encountering each other, they're not forming associations with each other. They're really just independent molecules. That's different from a salt. Sodium chloride forms because of that electrostatic attraction. But if you have many sodiums and many chlorides, they'll attract each other from all sides electrostatically. And so you don't have just a little unit of sodium chloride and another little unit of sodium chloride like you do with oxygen molecules that aren't interacting with each other. You have a chunk of sodium chloride that's as big as you want, depending on how many sodiums and chlorides you have. Literally chunks of salt bigger than buildings, which is where we mine salt from. See the difference between that? If you have a hell of a lot of oxygen, it's really just a lot of individual molecules. But if you have a big chunk of salt, that big chunk of salt is all really one particle. So we don't use the word molecule for ionic compounds. We use what? To denote the smallest piece of an ionic compound. In other words, the smallest piece you can have that still has the properties of that salt, which in the case of sodium chloride would be just one sodium ion and one chloride ion. What do we call that smallest piece that is still salty? We call it a formula unit. So salts occur in formula units, but if you have multiple formula units, they're all really connected together. Now notice you can't break it down any farther, because if you get below that, you no longer have salt, you have sodium again and chlorine again. That's why that's the smallest chunk. That's the utility of a formula unit. All right, anyway, back to carbon's tetravalence. It is able to form four bonds. It's the basis of organic chemistry, right? Carbon is. Organic chemistry is often quickly defined as, or an organic compound is usually quickly defined as a something that contains carbon. And that's true, but it really doesn't go far enough. Because pure carbon, for instance, contains carbon, of course. But pure carbon, in whichever form you want to talk about, whether it's diamond, which is pure carbon, or graphite in your pencil, which is pure carbon, neither of those is organic. So it's not enough to just say it contains carbon. An organic compound contains carbon. A carbon skeleton made out of carbon atoms bonded together covalently, along with hydrogen, carbon's forming bonds with hydrogen, and usually other things as well. But at least if you have carbon-hydrogen bonds, then you have an organic compound. And the reason there's a distinction made linguistically, and the idea behind organic, is that for a long time we thought that living things were chemically special, and that you could only get the things that organisms are made out of from organisms. There was no way to synthesize organic compounds in the lab, whereas inorganic things you could. Well, eventually, of course, we realized you could. The first one, urea was the first one, and now there's all kinds of organic compounds that we can make in the lab that don't even exist in nature, but they're still organic. We still use that word organic. From organisms was why we called it that. Organic chemistry is a huge subdiscipline of chemistry, and biochemistry, which is the chemistry of life, is really just a subset of organic chemistry. Okay. Carbon has this tetravalence, and because it's 4, which is greater than the valence of most other atoms, like hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, valence of 1 for hydrogen, 2 for oxygen, 3 for nitrogen, the fact that it has a valence of 4 and can make 4 bonds means that there's many more combinations when it comes to getting carbons together with other molecules. Because if you can make 4 bonds, and will, it's not just that it can, it's going to form 4 bonds in any compound it's involved in, but there's multiple ways that you can do that. If you have 4 bonds that you need to make, you can make 4 individual bonds, 4 single bonds, or you can make 2 double bonds. A double bond is really just an arrangement in which each of the 2 atoms shares 2 of its own electrons with the other. So there's 4 total electrons involved. It's just like 2 single bonds at the same time between the same 2 atoms. So 2 double bonds still add up to 4 bonds. Or you could make a triple bond and a single bond to get to your 4 bonds. That alone gives you more possibilities. But then also, when you think about 4 single bonds, you could make those 4 single bonds with 4 of the same kind of atom, or 1 of one kind of atom, 3 of another kind, 2 and 2. There's added versatility because of that. And there's going to be even more versatility when we look at the next slide, or a slide that's coming up. Anyway, that's the importance of tetravalence. It allows for a lot of different combinations of atoms involving carbon bonds. We can see some simple organic molecules here just as representatives. When we use these dot diagrams, that's just useful to remind us that every individual or single covalent bond is always going to involve 2 electrons, 1 from each of the 2 atoms. So that's why those are there. And the other electrons are just ignored. The ones that aren't involved in sharing are just not put there, just for simplicity. I think I've beat that slide to death. Let's go to the second slide now. Oh, when do we quit? Right now? Man. Okay, that's fine with me.